okay on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the committee should get a letter to that effect from LAA, and if the bill sponsors don't have them already, if they have them already, it'd be fine, but I think that would be appropriate for this committee to make sure that question's answered.
Further questions for Mr. Polly? Mike, you'll be in the audience during the remaining discussion on this matter. I think I'm going to kind of switch gears here a little bit of out of order. Unless, Bill, you have a commitment, I'd like to bring up public safety just to perhaps answer a couple of the questions that have been tossed out. Dell, you're probably more familiar with the use of marijuana than we are. I'm not saying on a personal usage basis, but you've probably been exposed to those who have, and probably have had a lot of on your possession from drug busts or whatever the case might be. So maybe you can kind of clarify for us the different varieties or the compound differences.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to answer one of the questions that was being asked previously, that the drug units that work for the Alaska State Troopers and local law enforcement advise that the average plant, if you will, in Alaska produces about 4 ounces. And that's the average. It can be anywhere from some 1 ounce in a scraggly little plant to sometimes in as much as 10 when it's fully harvested, and plants can grow to be 10 feet tall in the right kind of circumstances. So there is certainly a room in the six plants, three flowering at any one time in the 1 ounce possession. One could argue that that's a sufficient amount so you don't have to run to the locker too often. In reference to a question, if I might, earlier about our concern in law enforcement about you could possess an ounce, six plants, three flowering, or more if medically necessary. The concern was, okay, what is medically necessary since it's not defined anywhere? If you said plus another pound in reserve in the trunk of your car, it might make more sense to us. But I will hearken back to the days when I was a young officer at the Anchorage Police Department, and marijuana was initially, through the Raven decision, determined to be an appropriate source of pleasure for Alaskans. And initially it was you could possess a marijuana for your personal use, and it was very shortly thereafter that a gentleman in Anchorage had about 200 to 300 pounds. A dealer, by any other stretch of the imagination, claimed to be that this was his personal stash. It was then that this body argued ad nauseum and came up with a 4 ounce minimum or maximum that you could possess. And I just don't want to see us go through that again if that's at all possible. I think the or medically necessary, unless it's defined someplace, is very difficult. If my officers or local police department find a guy with a pickup load, is that medically necessary? I suppose you could find somebody who might testify that's the case. But I would like, and testified consistently through these hearings regarding this bill, a bright line for law enforcement, i.e., how much can you have, where can you have it, and are you registered? And who's your primary caregiver? And that's basically what we have asked. The people have spoken, we're not trying to change that or roll that back. But if you're an officer working midnight shifts and you find somebody, we need to know if they are legally in possession. If not, then we are obligated to enforce the law, seize it, and charge that individual. And that's why we wanted to see registration, because if they're not registered, but under the original MMA, could possess marijuana, then we're going to have to backtrack at some point in time. We got to take care of that plant, make sure we don't destroy it. Lots of little problems in dealing with that. And we preferred to have somebody registered said, why do you have an ounce of marijuana, Bob? Because I'm a registered user. Good. You have a good evening. And that certainly was our intent. And I've sort of rattled on here, but I'll be glad to answer any other questions I can.
There are several questions, but I think you kind of hit on at least one of my concerns when you talked about the individual with a pickup load of marijuana. Is it medically necessary? Well, arguably, somebody could argue, yes, it probably is, but it would seem to me that with the amounts that we have placed in in this particular proposition, that probably is sufficient enough, understanding that, one, generally speaking, I would think that the user, the end user here, are more than likely terminally ill. And number two, if that's the premise, they're not going to be around for a pickup load full of marijuana usage, which then creates, I think, a bigger problem for law enforcement in the disposition of that truckload of marijuana. I guess the question I have is, what procedures would be available? Say you have a caregiver and you have a pound or two of marijuana, that if that's what's determined to be medically justified in that individual home of the person who's using it, that person then succumbs to whatever disease they were suffering from, they still have a pound of marijuana. Is it then incumbent upon the medical caregiver to dispose of that through the department, or are there other mechanisms that could be utilized?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I suppose that's an option, although I doubt that many people would follow that particular one. I mean, there's nothing in the MMA that I'm aware of that would require you to do that. Certainly when this bill was, or excuse me, when this particular law was put before the public, it did envision terminal people for the most part. That's mostly what you saw on television, people saying they ought to have the right to do that, and I certainly don't disagree with that. But as you have heard today in other hearings, there's certainly a broader group that intends to use this. I don't have an answer to your question. I would assume that if the patient who you were the primary caregiver for died and there was a pound of marijuana, an illegal substance in your possession, you can't do that. How the police or law enforcement finds out about that, I don't know, because we're certainly not going to go around reading the obituaries and knocking on doors asking for their marijuana back. I mean, it's simply not an option. It just doesn't make sense at all. But that situation that you outlined, I assume, could. Under the MMA, under the proposed bills that are before you, there would be a maximum of an ounce in possession of usable marijuana and six plants, three flowering, which is still a substantial amount of marijuana by any stretch of the imagination, which would still put you in that same position with six plants, yeah, and nobody there.
And per your testimony, six plants could be a pound.
Yes, sir, it could
easily
be.
Easily. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for having to step out. Dell, was there discussion about the variety of strength in addition to the amount that a plant can grow, how many leaves it may make? But I know when I lived in California, there was a thing called something gold. I think it was Columbia gold. And that was supposed to be a lot stronger than the local stuff. And I understand that in Alaska, there's even stronger than that. So you've got three flowering that might have a pound on each, and they might be this two or three times strength. Are we going someplace we don't want to go?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, potentially, but I mean, the MMA calls for that amount. I mean, and I guess we can discuss that or whether that's appropriate in the strengths. There certainly is a substantial increase in the THC content of marijuana from 25 or 30 years ago when I first started running into as an enforcement officer. Matanuska Thunder Stuff is a pretty strong marijuana and nationally recognized as being that. Maui Waui is another fairly strong version of it, and other names that don't even come to mind. It's just difficult to say. I mean, that's one of the things. We're not prescribing a 6-milligram pill. We're prescribing marijuana, and you could have some that couldn't do anything to you to some that puts you feeling pretty good. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but it was about the best I can do.
Well, you haven't, and where we're kicking around this thing about how much you should have, I guess TCP?
THC
is kind of what we're really after, but probably enforcement is impractical or if not impossible. It's not like alcohol where you can take someone and say, boom, you've had too many THCs.
No, sir. You can tell if there's THC in the blood.
But,
if you've had marijuana by a blood test, but I don't think you can tell the strength of it. I don't
or how you got it, whether you ate it or smoked it or...
ingested it in some manner, yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Jeanette?
Yeah, I was concerned about how fast do these plants grow? I mean, if you had a little plant and let it grow to be a flowering plant, what kind of a time frame are we talking about?
Chairman, you're getting a little bit beyond my expertise, but I do know that substantial investment is made in greenhouse operations and grow lights in the Matanuska Valley. And I would assume, and I have heard it said, that you could turn over the plants probably 3 to 4 times a year and harvest 3 to 4 times a year, is what I understand. I don't think I can be more definitive than that because I'm not an expert in it.
Well, one more question, just quickly, I understand that if you participated in the use of marijuana, that that does stay in your bloodstream a long time, 30 days or so, to indicate that you have?
Mr. Chairman, I have been aware of tests out to 30 days that it was detectable in pre-employments and other kinds of tests.
That's where I'd heard it, too.
Yes. I think I'm just worrying about the registration. So currently, if someone were stopped, it's a basically voluntary thing. They wouldn't have had to have registered. But if you found them with marijuana, then you would just go the next step and ask why and try to see if it was verifiable. Isn't that how it would work now, or how does it work?
Chairman, Representative Kutula, what I would envision happening is if you were, let's say you're in a vehicle accident, for lack of another one, the marijuana is laying on the seat of the vehicle and you're transporting it to your residence, wherever you got it, and say, what's that over there, Dell? Sitting in my baggie, 1 ounce of marijuana. What are you doing with that? I'm a registered marijuana user. I need it. I said, fine, have a nice day. If you didn't have the card and we couldn't, and you weren't a registered individual, we got a couple options. We'd look you in the eye and try to determine whether or not you look sick enough to have marijuana, or presuming all of that you're not, seizing the marijuana and charging you with possession of it and then having it potentially undone in court and having to give the marijuana back. I thought, in my view of the world, that that was not a good utilization of the criminal justice resources, officers' time, court time, prosecutor time, and that mandatory registration, essentially a get-out-of-jail-free or avoid-jail-free card, was probably more appropriate. You show the card at that time. If you've forgotten your card at home, we're able to verify it with your driver's license and the registry.
Could I ask to follow up? Well, in a state where we don't like to register our guns even, I don't know, we don't... I just see the same problem with prescription drugs themselves. I mean, if you stop someone and they have a purse full of pills open, then you see those, wouldn't you have sort of the same problem? You'd have to follow up and decide whether or not they... Assuming you could tell it was a controlled pill.
I would probably, if I were an officer on the street and there was some pills, I think the first question most cops would ask if they searched a purse or a person said, do you have a prescription for this?
Right.
It's not the registry, but it's a logical question, and the prescription bottle with your name on it and from Pay and Save Drugs is the functional equivalent of the marijuana registry card here. As Representative Dyson said, if the federal government were to make this a prescribable drug, we probably wouldn't have to have this conversation, and the amounts might be controlled and the strength of it might be much better controlled than it is now.
Thank you.
Norm?
Mr. Chairman, we were talking a while ago about quality. I was going to ask Deputy Commissioner Smith, I think you answered it in part when you said you were not able to grade any of the quantity of the THC. You said you couldn't in the blood, but when they make a bust of a large growing area, could you tell in the potency of the plants, does that have any bearing on the charges and or the evidence that you have?
To the chair, Representative Roberg, we certainly at the crime lab can determine the THC content, but I do not believe in to my knowledge, that it would enhance a charge one way or the other. The total amount of marijuana you possess, not necessarily the strength, would depend on what the charge would be.
Well, Mr. Chairman, follow up. Are there not concentrations of cannabis like hashish that can be manufactured from marijuana? Then how would you handle hashish vis-a-vis marijuana? Isn't that marijuana? How would that be defined?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Roepberg, I don't feel prepared to answer that with any level of certainty. So I assume there is ways you can concentrate it, but I would be wading in water way over my head if I tried to opine about that. So.
Perhaps we should reserve the question for people more knowledgeable. Growth or manufacture of such things.
Joe?
Yes, in deference to what my colleague Representative Katula said about registration, it seems like we've got cards that teenagers have to carry to get into a joint. It seems like we could carry something to have a joint then.
Representative Croft.
Just a couple, Mr. Chairman. Is it illegal for me to have Valium without a prescription? I'm trying to find an example of something else that I can compare to.
To my knowledge, through the chair, Representative Croft, I believe you would need a prescription for Valium.
Can you just give me, I just want to use something as a concrete example. Is there a better one that I can compare it to? Something you know that would be illegal for me to have without a prescription that generally relieves pain or does the types of things that this would do? Codeine?
I heard somebody say codeine. I suspect the particular strength of codeine and prescription strength codeine without a prescription would be illegal.
Yes, sir.
So if you pull me over and you find that I have pills, I don't know if it's in pills, but pills of codeine, and you, as you said, you'd ask, do you have a prescription? And I don't have it there. What would be the standard procedure to do then? I didn't have the prescription, or I'm ornery and won't show it to you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, I guess it's situational. I mean, I envision a situation where a person, say, had 50 codeine pills of extra strength and not from Canada. Then you might say, do you have a prescription for these? No, I don't. Well, what are you doing with them? Well, I'm doing something. I could see a situation where the officer might seize them for the time being and look into this further.
There's no list of licensed codeine users. There's no...
Not that I'm aware of.
Is there... then would you check into it by what, trying to find out if they had a prescription?
If they said Dr. To the chair, if they said Dr. Feelgood, who I've heard referenced in this document here, Dr. Feelgood had prescribed them to me, follow-up would be appropriate to call Dr. Feelgood's office and say, do you have a client by the name of Eric Croft who was in possession of 50 pills? I said, well, I've never heard of him. Then we'd sort of proceed along that line and ultimately probably get to Mr. Guanelli's office, intake office.
It eventually might be a warrant then to figure out this, or they just bring it forward?
If you didn't arrest the person at the time, you would probably have to go back with a warrant and do that if you want to charge for possession. I guess you could throw caution to the wind and make the arrest right then, but what I'm saying is a reasonable application of this, if there's some reason that you didn't think. I mean, if a 15, 16, 17-year-old kid's got 50 to 75 pills, then I think there's probable cause to believe that. Or somebody else that you would find it difficult to believe. It's all situation, very difficult for me just to answer that flat out. I believed, as a law enforcement officer still do, to try to be fair in the application of the law. And the scenario will be laid out. Might result in arrest, or might result in, I'm going to take these, I'll give them back to you. If you legally should have these in your prescriptions at home,
you'd have the obligation to take care of them. You couldn't burn them or whatever because they might be legally.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
A couple other lines. So when Raven was passed and we decided to implement it with some sideboards, we chose 4 ounces of marijuana as what a legal person without any medical justification could keep.
To the chair, in the Raven decision, it said you could have excuse me, the Raven decision said you could have marijuana. And ultimately, this body came up with 4 ounces after rather lengthy discussions about whether the stems and seeds should count in the total body count. I mean, I remember that specifically because I was a little offended by the time as a young officer that spent discussing that. But yeah, it was 4 ounces, pure and simple. You didn't have to be anybody. You could just possess that much, which still did not address the federal law prohibiting the possession of marijuana, nor does this particular one, as a matter of fact. Representative James, if I might, had said something about growing your own. I guess if the good Lord dropped it into your backyard and you can grow it, then perhaps you can start it that way. But I still don't understand how you could legally access the marijuana to start your grow under the current scenario.
Get the first seed, then.
Exactly.
You might pick it up on the street.
That was what I was trying to get. So when we were faced with how much a healthy person could have in their own possession, for personal use, which was some semblance of the Raven standard, we said 4 ounces. And with somebody who has been certified as having a serious medical condition, we're saying 1 here. I wanted to just finally, what is the mechanism, assuming that we do change the law from optional to mandatory registration, who gets to see that list, and how onerous would it be on you to have to get a warrant to search that list? To have somebody, in this case the court, say, all right, Dell, go look at the list or punch the computer up for somebody's name.
Through the chair, Representative Croft. How I envision it working would be that if you either have the card with you, which is identifiable and presumably not a fake.
That's easy, or I don't now.
And you don't have a card, and you say, I'm still a registered marijuana user, so let me see your driver's license, or what you already have. Then calling my dispatch as an officer and saying, run up the registry names that are provided by the Department of Health and Social Services as registry information, and see if there's an Eric Croft on there with this.
Let's use Joe instead.
Joe Green, since he's not here. Is there a Joe Green on there? And he said, yes, there is, and his date of birth is such and such. And I said, okay, that squares with what I've got here relative to this driver's license, and let the individual go. If I'm unable to do that, the other option to me is, again, charging, taking the marijuana from the person, and that's why I would like to have access to that registry in the middle of the night, if necessary, to preclude having to charge somebody that might legitimately, under this MMA, be able to possess marijuana.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Didn't the original initiative, though, say, it didn't say mandatory, and that's part of what we're discussing, but it did say that no person shall be permitted to access except the individual people and except for authorized employees of the department in the course of their official duties and authorized employees of state or local law enforcement agencies who have stopped or arrested a person who claims to be engaged in. So it gave you authority to do that search that you think before, right?
It did, but you did not have to register. So I could say, I'm not registered because I object to that particular approach, but I can legally have this. And then the officer's got the quandary of whether or not this guy's telling him the truth, and do I let him go and find out that he didn't, or do I seize his dope and find out that he had about 24 hours to live and this he wanted to smoke this marijuana. Not a position I want to put our officers in. I want to be able to sort it out. As testified by Mr. Pauly, their view of the proponents of the Marijuana Act had a different view. They were pushing to have people register, and if you didn't, tough noogies, if you will, they were going to get charged. I felt a different
tough
point.
Noogies, is that a term of art?
That's just a term of art. That I would rather sort them out and not charge if that was to save the system and to save the individual the hassle of being charged.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you, Del.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to call Mr. Guarnelli up.
Here from the Department of Law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. Dean Guarnelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Let me say, first of all, that the administration has certainly heard the voters. They want to provide marijuana for people with debilitating medical conditions. And the aim of the administration in working with the sponsors of these two bills is to make this a workable system. We don't think that the current initiative, because of certain flaws in it, probably unintentional flaws, but nonetheless flaws would lead to problems with the implementation and administration of this program and would ultimately lead to its failure. There are a number of problems. The bills fix, I believe, all of them, and so the administration supports these efforts. I'd certainly be happy to go over sort of a litany of the problems with you, but I think it might be more helpful at this point, since you've heard testimony and other committees have heard testimony previously, to simply respond to questions. But I'd be happy to go over these issues one by one if that's the committee's choice.
Dean, before we get into anything in depth, I asked a question very early on as to whether or not an Elks Club would be considered a public place. It is restricted to members only. Would one be able to go inside and use marijuana under the current scheme?
The particular provision doesn't use the term public place. It uses uses the term open to the general public. And I think the Elks Club, private clubs, would not be places open to the general public. I think, you know, an argument could certainly be constructed where it is open to the public, but I believe that that if a court is applying that particular language, particularly dealing with criminal prosecutions, and this is largely where it would arise, terms in the law are construed against the government, against the state, and in favor of a defendant. So I think that it probably would be permissible to use marijuana for medical purposes in a private club. Now, having said that, I also think that it would be permissible for the private club to simply, you know, have a bylaw or something like that saying we don't want our members doing that. And I think that they could certainly do that. You know, post a sign out, you know, distribute notice to the members, give them adequate notice, and stop them from doing that. And if somebody wanted to do that, then you know, they could take some action. But I think they probably would be allowed to do it in that place.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
Representative Roquebrune,
I think in many jurisdictions it's just the converse, where the smoking clubs are established for the very purpose to circumvent the problem. So they create bylaws allowing that and then centralize the use of the provision of the material.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. Dean, Mr. Representative Roquebrune had a question earlier about could this possibly be construed as repealing the initiative? And has the Department of Law taken a position? Has an opinion been asked for or given? Or?
To the chair, no opinion has been solicited from us. But as part of our review on the various versions of the bills, we did determine that at least since the time of, I guess, the first sponsor substitutes, that those versions would not constitute a repeal of the initiative. The law in Alaska is that an initiative can't be repealed within 2 years, but it can be amended at any time, and that has been construed by the courts to give the legislature very broad discretion to amend initiatives. What the Alaska Supreme Court has said is that as long as the basic purpose and structure still remains, the legislature can change a lot of the policy choices that the voters adopted. And the basic purpose and structure to allow, you know, very sick people to have limited access to marijuana is certainly still retained in any of these versions. So we believe that it would be constitutional.
Thank you.
That's my conclusion as well. Mm-hmm. Representative Curtula?
No, I got mine answered. Thanks.
Representative Roper.
Chairman, perhaps I should have asked Ms. Smith, but I'll direct this to Mr. Glinelli. If the U.S. attorney here decided to be more aggressive in the enforcement of federal laws, could Alaska state troopers make an apprehension on a judgment call area and then turn the evidence over to the U.S. attorney for prosecution under federal law?
Through the chair, that is something that's possible. And that is actually something that has happened with a few large growing operations, marijuana growing operations in the Mat-Su Valley several years ago. We took a few of those cases federally, in other words, allowed the U.S. Attorney's Office to prosecute those cases, provided them with the evidence, and got fairly stiff sentences, and it created a situation where the marijuana growers were much more willing to go into state court and plead to a state offense rather than be subjected to federal prosecution. But that's really only with the largest growing operations. I just had met with the U.S. attorney last week, not on this particular subject, but on a variety of subjects involving narcotics, and he complained again about having a staff of only 10 attorneys to do all of the criminal and civil work for the United States in all of Alaska, and so he's really not in a position to take any but the very largest marijuana cases.
And to follow up, Mr. Chairman, the thought escaped me. It's been one of a cuddly moment. Oh, I know. Mr. Quinelli, has the Attorney General of the United States articulated the policy of the Clinton administration about dealing with the states that passed these initiatives? I understood they were. I don't know if that's occurred yet, about whether or not the federal government would intervene to enforce these things, or are they going to beg off on resources, as you just mentioned, or has the President's administration articulated specific policy?
Through the chair, it's my understanding that there are a number of discussions underway in terms of developing some sort of national approach to medical marijuana. I think that would involve probably a number of facets. One, research and study of the issue and developing adopting some kind of position that's based on actual study rather than anecdotal evidence, and then following up on that, trying to prevent the most prevalent abuses. But I think that in most areas, the U.S. attorney staff are certainly not in a position to take any but the largest cases, even in California. They only started intervening in dealing with the large marijuana clubs that sprung up in California after their initiative. So I really don't think it's in the cards to expect the federal government to deal with this in terms of enforcement. Now, maybe in terms of research and studying that yes, but not enforcement.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Connelly, without some of the changes in this particular statute, would you see that the problem of enforcing even the Alaska state law if the marijuana-type clubs were to be formed in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I do. I think that there's a particular provision in the initiative which is a little tricky to read, but it says that a registered patient may not sell or distribute marijuana to anyone who the patient knows is not entitled to use it. And if you sort of take out all the negatives and restructure that, what it means is, if you don't ask if you don't ask if they don't have a card or if they don't tell you that they're not entitled to, a registered patient could sell marijuana to other people. And I think that kind of provision is very likely to result in, marijuana clubs or places where registered patients could lawfully sell marijuana to other people who may not even be patients themselves, who may not be entitled to it. As long as they don't ask, then they could do that. And I think that the real danger of allowing someone to possess, more than an ounce and six plants is this provision. I mean, you were allowed to sell to other people. California, they were able to shut down the marijuana clubs because there was nothing specific in their law that suggested that marijuana clubs were legal. In Alaska, we've got a fairly you know, an oddly worded provision, but something that I think would allow that. So I think that's one of the real dangers of this particular initiative.
Sam Murkowski.
I'm really stretching here. I was on an airplane with Gene Theriault, and he needed to read my Fairbanks paper because there was a clip in it from, I want to say, Arizona or possibly California. California, Arizona, or Oregon, one of the western states, where there were some individuals who were growing what seemed to me to be an incredible amount of marijuana. They had claimed it was for personal medical use under the new medical marijuana statutes, and the state was going ahead and they were to make a determination as to what constituted reasonable for medical purposes. Are you at all familiar with what I'm talking about?
I'm not. All I can, my only experience with dealing with, you know, amounts of marijuana is what Deputy Commissioner Smith referred to many years ago after the Raven decision, when it was permissible to have small amounts of marijuana for your personal use. We brought a number of cases to grand juries where people had several pounds of marijuana, and found that grand juries simply would not return indictments because of the excuse that, you know, that these were people, they liked to party a lot, they liked to have a lot of friends over, and a few pounds of marijuana was okay for personal use. So that kind of experience, I think, led us to the conclusion that you can come up with all sorts of excuses and you never know what a jury is going to buy. So I think that there are certainly some dangers in leaving it so completely open.
Further questions from Mr. Winnelli? Mr. Roper?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Winnelli, are there other loopholes in the initiative that need to be closed along the same line inclusive to have more? Or is that the whole litany of things you thought needed to be taken?
Well, there are others, but I think they've been touched on. The mandatory registration, because of its effect on practical police practices. I think Mr. Pauley mentioned the fact that if this is not considered a quote controlled substance under Alaska law, you can possess firearms under the influence of marijuana. Potentially, you may even be able to drive under the influence of marijuana. Those kinds of things. I think that the whole way it treats, you know, the seizure of property and the limits on police officers really takes this substance and treats it differently even than other prescription drugs. I think there are all of those kinds of things that really need to be corrected, and they have been corrected in this bill.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Dean. We'll next turn to the witness list, Mr. Bill Kozlowski. Incidentally, for the members' edification, there is no teleconferencing this bill at this point.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Kozlowski. I'm from Juneau. I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. I'm 27 years old. I have severe hemophilia. Severe hemophilia means that my blood does not clot. I can have spontaneous bleeds from sitting down on the ground. I can bump into a door and have my hips swell three times its size. I have been prescribed narcotics extensively throughout my life, to the point where I was taking 60 milligrams of morphine a day and 28 4 milligram dilaudid tablets a day. That's a lot of narcotics, and that is for pain that I have that is very, very real. During those times of being prescribed large amounts of narcotics, I became unable to exist in a normal life. I could not remember having a conversation with anybody. I could not remember what I did yesterday or the day before. I could not hold work. I could not be counted on because of the pain that I was in and enduring because of the blood, the bleeding that would happen in my body daily. Up until 5 months ago, I was taking that much narcotics, which, if you know anything about narcotics, that's a lot. That'll kill most people. The reason that it probably doesn't kill me is because I have an enormous tolerance to those narcotics, because the more you use those narcotics, the more your body builds up a resistance to them, to the point where you need more. On top of the narcotics, it makes it worse to come off of them. The withdrawal of morphine is something I would wish upon no human being, and I have had to endure it many times in my life. It is an existence where you sweat, you vomit, you cry, you spend the most miserable existence you can imagine living through. In the last 5 months, I've stopped using narcotics on that extensive. My life will never be free of narcotics because of the disability I have, but on a day-to-day basis, it can be. Marijuana is one thing that I can use that can allow me to remember a conversation, to have a life, to go for a walk with my wife. Small things, things that you may take for granted, but are very, very, very important. I hear you talk about usage and an ounce or 4 ounces. In reality, over time, people build immunity to these things. And when you're talking about people that are terminally ill, we're not getting better. We are always going to have these problems. Nobody's going to come up with a cure for hemophilia. Nobody's going to come up with a cure for hepatitis C or HIV right now. Those things are debilitating. As far as House Bill 213 goes, I have real issues with having to register my name as somebody who uses marijuana as a medicine. I've had to endure discrimination because of hemophilia. 90% of hemophiliacs have HIV. They got HIV through blood in the 80s. I am one of the luckiest hemophiliacs that I know. I'm the only hemophiliac in the state of Alaska that does not have HIV. I'm one of 6 on the West Coast with the disease that I have. I find it very hard to listen to. People make jokes about how many joints and how much pot is this going to do and this and that, because what you're forgetting to think about is that this is about pain. This is about more physical pain than you could ever imagine, because if you could imagine it, this would not be an issue for you. I can tell you that as being a 27-year-old man, you'd look at me and you would think, that guy can lift 10 pounds. But I'm telling you, I can't. Lifting 10 pounds, moving that chair, can cause me to have an internal bleeding, which can cause me pain for weeks. The blood products that I use cost $2,000 a pop. Sometimes I use that 2 or 3 times a day for months. Last year, it was $550,000 for my blood costs and for pharmaceuticals. I personally have spent thousands of dollars of my money on pharmaceuticals. Right now, with medical marijuana, I can grow it in my home. I can take care of my own needs. I can be a productive member of society. And the only other option for me is narcotics. Marijuana or narcotics. It seems pretty simple to me. I can either be a junkie and have a short life, which my life is already short, or I can make the life that I have the best I can. And the laws don't matter to people that are in this position. It doesn't matter to us if it's illegal or not, because I'm going to die anyways of something that is going to be much more painful than anything the state can do to me. In ending, I have one last thing to say. If you have faith in the people that elect you, then you should have faith in their choices and legislation, and you should give it a chance to work as it is. Are there any questions?
Representative Roper.
Mr. Kozlowski, is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for coming here today, really. And I think our committee appreciates hearing your testimony. But how do you feel, do you believe that people without any
you know, major debilitating medical condition should be able to take advantage of your condition and use to be able to smoke marijuana, piggybacking off of your problems? Well, what's your opinion on that?
Well, I hear that argument quite often, actually. In my opinion is that right now we live in a society where you can go to your doctor and they will prescribe you morphine, they will prescribe you Demerol, Dilaudid, Methadone, all drugs that are so much harder on your body, all legally prescribed. And if the argument were true that if you legalize marijuana from people for medicine, that everybody will be smoking it, if that were true, people would be using morphine in the streets, which is a much more addictive drug. Right now, if I were to stop smoking marijuana for pain, I could go to sleep. It may be painful, but I would be able to sleep, and my body would not have to sweat out narcotics for up to a week. If I was taking narcotics for a month, if I stopped, it could kill me because of the toxicness of those drugs. So I'm not sure if I answered your question or not.
Well, in part, but I guess I'm concerned about, if I were in your position, I maybe wouldn't really care. But it seems to me as if certain people are using, you're being used, if you will, to a degree, to allow people to do something which has formerly been illegal, and they're going to be acting in what has formerly been illegal under the guise of a condition and for an excuse that I think is very rationally justified in your condition. So they're kind of getting away with something when they're not ill, they don't have a problem like you have, and they're going to be taking advantage of it because they're of loopholes in the law.
And those people would be subject to the same regulations that are the same laws that apply to morphine, methadone, Demerol, Dilaudid, all those classes of drugs, which if Mr. Croft here had morphine and he was taking it that somebody had given him, it would still be illegal. The same difference if I had marijuana and I just gave it to my wife would be illegal for me to have a prescription or recommendation.
Well, Mr. Kozlowski, I think that we've heard testimony today that that's really not quite the case. That's why we're looking at modifying the law to make sure that is the case.
But it seems to me that by having to be put on a list that can be checked to verify for criminal investigation or prosecution, which as the law that I understand it from speaking with people, that's how it works, that's kind of like fishing from a stocked pool. Because you have a list of people that you know are smoking marijuana. You know for fact. What is to protect me from that having that abused by somebody that is really against the use of marijuana for medical or any purpose?
Mr. Chairman,
what's to protect me from that?
I'd suggest that anybody else using a controlled substance or a subscription is on a list. They're on a list of a pharmacy for the formulary they were given by the pharmacist and or their doctor. So
and how is that registry accessed?
How is access?
Yeah, I mean, what's the process?
Perhaps, I'm not sure about, I think it is confidential in terms of the pharmacy and under our particular provisions of licensure that's not generally available to the public.
Because I noticed before when the person from public safety was speaking, they had said that, you know, you could call up to a doctor's office and ask for verification if that was a patient. And I can tell you for a fact that you can't do that, no matter who you are, unless I have given them a release of medical information. That's... you know, not possible for them
to
call
it. It should be confidential, right?
You know, and it should be confidential. When I was talking about discrimination, people, because I had hemophilia, assumed I was HIV positive, assumed that, and treated me so. So, do you have AIDS yet? Many times I heard that from doctors, from nurses, because so many people with my disease had gotten HIV. I don't want to live through that stigma. I don't want to have to live through, because we live in a McCarthyistic drug war. It's McCarthyism, and it's sad, because I am not a criminal. I am not somebody that actively hurts any individual. I am only simply looking to take care of my own medical needs, which is not a lot to ask. And the voters of Alaska have agreed that the people that need it should be eligible to use it.
That certainly is the agreement, I think, among the committee members. I think is what we're trying to do is to
to ensure that there are no loopholes so that the public that went and voted in support of this get exactly what they want. So I guess my question, Ms. Kozlowski, is, and I'm looking at the amount side of it. You mentioned, you know, if you grow your own, I couldn't agree with you more. I think if I were in a position where I was spending thousands of dollars a year and I could grow my own marijuana plants, I'd do the same, no question. I guess the question I have, and maybe based on experience, you can tell the committee, how many plants would be enough? Now, you've got a tremendous amount of pain. I would think you would be in the far-reaching category of persons who would be suffering and would ultimately use marijuana, so maybe your usage would be a little more than, let's say, someone that didn't have that same level of pain. But based on your own situation, can you tell the committee what you feel would be the necessary amount?
My own situation.
I think what we don't want to see is a field of marijuana plants available to someone other than to who was initially registered or able through the to the law to use it, and that person eventually goes on somewhere else. We're going to have an overabundance of potential stock plants there that may come into use by someone that was not eligible. Therefore, that person is going to benefit from your situation or for those who need it.
To me, it seems like police every day can discern if somebody's using tobacco legally, if they're using alcohol legally. They can discern that information. If somebody is driving with a truckload of marijuana, it probably is not for medicinal use. It seems pretty logical. Not one person that I've ever encountered, and I know a lot of people that use medical marijuana, would ever claim a truckload would be their necessity. As far as personal use goes, and what I use for myself, I personally smoke 1 ounce every 10 days to control the pain that I have. Without that, I would be up to 60 milligrams of morphine and 28 4-milligram tablets of Dilaudid a day.
Can you get that to me again?
60 milligrams of morphine and 28 4-milligram tablets of Dilaudid. All have been prescribed to me by doctors. All I really want to get across is that 6 plant, you're splitting hairs over things that I don't know how you could ever control. I don't know how you could ever control if somebody had, you know, if they got 1 ounce from one plant or 2 ounces from this plant, because it does vary so greatly.
Well, I think you've answered part of my question. Satisfies my mind. 1 ounce, 10 days, 3 ounces a month. Do you know and maybe this would be more apropos for the department, what an ounce of marijuana runs on the street? What's the street value if you were to purchase from someone illegally?
Between $500 and $600.
For 1 ounce?
Mm-hmm. Ooh. See, which makes it also very hard.
It's certainly gone up since my younger days. I remember.
As you return,
I can remember hearing $25. But
the lid.
Okay, lid. That's it. In your usage today of 1 ounce every 10 days, is that how it started off, or have?
No,
your system build up this immunity.
My system has built up a tolerance to that, just the same way it built up a tolerance to the morphine and methadone and Dilaudid and Demerol. What happens in your body is that you fill up the synapses that help to alleviate pain. And over time, the more you use, the more you're going to need, because it's just not going to work. I mean, if anybody in this room took 60 milligrams of morphine, you would die. But after a year or two of using that every day, that would be the only thing that would work for someone in my position. So it could go up. And I mean, For me, I use marijuana when my body hurts, when there is blood in my joints, when my hips have swollen or my shoulders have swollen, to where it hurts just to get up and go to the bathroom. Marijuana does not make me high. It doesn't make me feel good. But what it does is it gets me to a point where the pain is not the only thing I can think of.
Okay, I'm trying to work out the math here.
Mr. Chairman.
1 ounce equals 3 ounces a month. One plant is 4 ounces. If you can turn over this product, regrowth it, I guess, every three or four times
a
year.
Before your equation, you need the, how long does it take to grow a decent size?
Depends on what you're, depends on how you do it. There's many methods to grow marijuana. Some people use a system called hydroponics, which every 6 to 8 weeks you can have a turnover of a crop. And if you use dirt, it's probably up to 3 months to 4 months for a crop.
So I guess worst case then, as indicated by the Department of Public Safety, about once a quarter you could turn over a crop.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Chairman, how big would that crop be though in terms of
It really does depend on, I mean, marijuana is very, it varies from strength to size to quality to growth to, I mean, basically it's as many different colors as a rainbow.
But Mr. Chairman, like in a 6 to 8 week hydroponic period, and you had 6 plants, about how many ounces could you get out of that?
Really depends on the marijuana that's being grown.
Your seed and everything else.
Yeah, it really does, because a lot of times, you know, you might get nothing. Your plants could get some kind of illness.
Well, Stormy, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me as a botanist and horticulture kind of guy that I fancy myself, that when you're growing crops, you don't grow them one at a time and then start germinating another one. You have to have more on the pipeline, so to speak, coming in to germinate and get growing, so they can be there more in a more timely fashion. So you just don't have 3 in bud and 3 behind them. I'm not sure the plant cycle works very well there. But the problem here, and I pointed that out to Mr. Krasowski, is that this little difficulty really was caused by the initiative, because those are the stipulated numbers in there. And with the bailout clause is what everybody's kind of concerned about, because it seems very open-ended. So.
Representative Murkowski.
Thank you. Mr. Kozlowski, you obviously are just the type of person that this initiative and this law was designed for. And I think all of us here at this table would certainly agree that it is people like you in situations like you're experiencing that you need to have this. So we need to make this work. Recognizing that we need to make it work for you, we also need to make it work for the rest of the public, whether it's law enforcement or whether it's the children out on the playground, which is where my perspective is on this. And I need to understand from a person like you who does need this, I need to understand the problems with the registration. You've indicated that there's a discriminatory impact or effect that you feel there's a stigma, if you will. And I guess I'm looking at this and saying, okay, if we make the registration be optional, then we put you in jeopardy if you're driving down the road. We have the scenario that Mr. Smith was talking about where you're not registered, you clearly need it. They're in the dilemma of, well, what do we do? Do we seize the marijuana or what have you? So in an effort to protect you, for lack of a better term, this is why the whole registration process has been proposed. But if it is not mandatory, then you are at risk, and we don't want you to be at risk. So how do we get from here to there?
my understanding that if I did become somehow in trouble with the law for medical marijuana, that under Measure 8, that as long as I had a doctor's recommendation that was documented in my medical file, that that would not be an issue. That's why, that was my understanding of how the registration, why, you know, you can register or you can't, because as long as a doctor has recommended for you, which is the way it should be between you and your doctor. And
if I may follow up on that, then, you know, we're in the situation where it's a 1 a.m. stop for whatever reason. It's a Friday night and nobody's going to be around at your doctor's office until Monday morning. And then we're in the Del Smith scenario of what does the officer do? Do they seize your marijuana, which you desperately need over the weekend? And yes, in fact, you do have a recommendation on file with your doctor, but as you've noted, and I think you're absolutely right, Mr. Smith's folks are not going to be able to call up the doctor at home and confirm whether or not there's been a recommendation, because that's unless you've authorized some kind of a release of that information. It's a catch-22. It's a very problematic situation, and I think we'd all like to think that it's not going to happen. But how do we protect you in that instance if there is no registration?
See, the registration is a catch-22, because we do, the state of Alaska has made a law that allows people to use medical marijuana. The United States of America still has not allowed that law. By putting my name on a list, a registry, so to speak, of things that are federally illegal, that's asking for a lot more problem. I mean, what happens? I mean, that's so hard for me to have to put my medical condition down that can be an open registry where my doctor has to write a letter stating what exactly it is I have, which that is crazy. You're asking people to state that they have HIV, that they have hepatitis, that they have all these gamut of things that probably is nobody's business. That's the problem that I have, is that you're asking me to be put on a list that is still federally illegal, which is more of a threat to me than the state is. Because reality is that I've used marijuana for 10 years, on and off for pain medication. Only in the last 5 months have I used it solely. And I've never had any problems with the law. I've never had any problems with the law. So I don't see the necessity of me being put on a list to protect me from something that I don't know what's going to happen. How is that going to affect me? How is that really going to protect me that my medical records are not going to be released, that somebody's not going to access those files and discriminate against me for the disability that I have?
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether we're going to have the other witnesses back up, but in terms of the confidentiality of who this information is released to, it's my understanding that it is just to law enforcement. It's not, I couldn't have access as a private individual or as a state representative to that list. Is that correct?
I think we'll bring them back up if you'd hold that question, but I think that would be my understanding of how this list would work. It'd be extremely confidential. It wouldn't be like the sex offender list where you could go on the internet and find out who's a sex offender. But I guess it would offer some satisfaction if the register, as part of being placed on that register, the physician did not have to identify the symptoms that led to your placement on it, but based on the AMA's oath, that whatever that was diagnosed was the correct diagnosis, the reason for placing you on there. Done so based on the physician's ability and his oath of office, if you will.
To me, I'm having to prove my innocence before I'm guilty of anything. It's to be, because I am not a criminal. I'm using something strictly for marijuana. If there came a point where a police officer knocked on my door and came to my house and said, are you growing marijuana? I'd be happy to show him my plants, and I'd be happy to show him my $40,000 worth of blood supply. I mean, it's people that have a medical problem have plenty to show what they have. One way or another, if it's not physical, they have medication that they are probably taking. They have some other documentation that they can show a police officer. The registry to me is an invasion of my privacy. And if a police officer can tell if I've had too much to drink, then he can look at a piece of paper, or look at my blood supply, or look at my syringes, or look at my sharps containers filled with needles, if he'd like to. That's enough registry for me to identify myself as a hemophiliac, or identify myself as somebody who uses this strictly medicinally.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to, it's interesting to see how this, the length of the whole ballot, the proposition of the initiative that was passed by the public, and it's interesting to know, I'm kind of curious to recall what it said in the short form on the ballot, because it seems quite clear to me that, number one, how this was sold to the public was clearly using the words, the department shall create and maintain a confidential registry of patients who applied for, etc. If there was not a registry, there was certainly expectation, I think, by the public that there would be a registry.
But it should be optional.
Well, no, I don't think the public believes that. I don't think the public knew that, and that's a lot of the problems with this initiative. And I'd suggest to Mr. Kozlowski that this is now, because it's been passed, is a statutory privilege and not a constitutional right. So the best thing to do to protect yourself and your ability in the future is to try to make some modifications in this law you live with. But I really understand how you feel about, I believe, I mean, your own rights. But I mean, I think what the privilege that was granted by the people of Alaska to meet your needs also has, you have some responsibility too with that, I think. So, just to let you know about that, and I'm sure the good representative next to me will take
that is my response.
I mean, we can go around in a circle on whether that's the case or not. Truly, I mean.
Well, I don't think I don't think this whole 9-page chapter was on the ballot. There's a short form question on the ballot, and people were sold that, and nobody reads the whole bloody law. I'm going to tell you, 99% of the people who voted didn't read this, and if 5% did, you know, 99% of them didn't understand it. I'm telling you.
But so. Excuse me, that's kind of silly to say, because that's like saying if 99% of people don't read these things, then how are you elected? How are you people elected? If these people are not paying attention and reading and being part of the process, how are you elected in your seats? These people do read.
That's
they easy. Are
that's
informed.
A yes and no. This is not. This is 9 pages of loopholes. But I mean, about the registry, though, I mean, we can debate that. I mean, I understand that. But I think there is an expectation there that there would be a registry. That's the way it's drawn. I mean, even if you read it in a relatively fast manner, you think there was a mandatory registry. You would. That's what you think.
Reading through that thing the first couple of times, I noticed that it wasn't. I did not have to mandatorily register because it is important to me. It is nobody's business what debilitating disorder I have. It's nobody's business.
Why have a registry then or in all then?
Because some people
need it.
Representative Roper, let the witness respond, please, before we get into a debate here.
Okay.
Let me ask you, Mr. Kozlowski,
if that ballot proposition, the way it was written, required the end user to register on a confidential list and to carry a card, would you have supported it?
I probably would have supported it because it was a necessity, not for just me. For me, I mean, realistically, $550,000 a year to keep me alive, am I really worth busting for medical marijuana? Really? Seriously, for the state of Alaska, for anybody, am I worth that? I'm here for the people that are too scared to talk, people that are afraid to say that they use marijuana for pain. I'm here for those people.
Thank you. Representative Petula.
I just appreciated your breaking in, because I think Mr. Kozlowski has been really courageous today coming in and testifying and putting himself at some risk, and I appreciate that and the explanations. I think that you can create a registry for the people who want to go do it, but for those who don't want to do it, they may be taking some kind of a risk. I also really appreciate what Mr. Smith said, because I truly believe that his intentions are good with it, but my own personal belief is, in a state where we don't want to register our guns, why do we want to register our medical conditions? So that's all. Thank you.
Well, we do register our guns somewhat if you carry them under your coat.
Mr. Chairman,
we're permitted, but yeah.
For the record, I wouldn't advocate registering conditions. I think the chairman made that point earlier.
No, I think it's tantamount to that, and that's what the witness is trying to say. So.
Well, I think we have some other invalid propositions or constitutional amendments before us that kind of deal with some of the problems that are endemic in drafting full chapters of law and selling the public on something. Also,
are there additional questions for Mr. Kozlowski? Sir, I appreciate you coming forward and providing us some great and valuable information on this matter.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I think the intent of the chair will be to take about a 15-minute at ease.
Mr. Chairman, this is a companion bill. What's the deal on this thing?
We're at ease. And continue the hearing. And the only other person I have on the list that wishes to testify is Mr. Finkstein. And the rest of the folks here, looks like they will be available to answer questions, including Elmer. Is that correct, or did you want to make a comment? Okay, why don't we do that, and David, and we'll bring you up. And
this is all on me.
Put this package together. Elmer, welcome. For the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Elmer Lindstrom, Special Assistant to Commissioner Perdue in the Department of Health and Social Services.
You talk about it.
Just very, very briefly, Mr. Chairman, we've worked with our sister agencies, the law enforcement community, public safety, and the Department of Law Criminal Division, to try to come up with recommendations that we could all live with and support as the administration. And my department brought a little bit different perspective to the issue than the law enforcement agencies. I think the testimony that you heard just preceding the break reflected some of the kind of concerns that we brought to the table. We were recognizing that law enforcement had concerns, legitimate concerns, but we wanted to be very certain that any solution that was crafted did not either make the administrative burden on my department difficult or unduly interfere with the doctor-patient relationship, which is key to making this program work. And perhaps most importantly, the issue of patient confidentiality, which I think you probably got a good sense of just a few moments ago. The bill has gone through numerous iterations. I am assuming that amendments that we were provided before the meeting will be before the committee for consideration, and with your permission, I'd like to just reference one of them in the context of the confidentiality issue.
I have those.
I have my own, what?
The Dyson ones?
Yeah, there's about six of them.
Yeah.
Wait, here they are.
Are those
here.
Yours or mine?
No, these are mine.
I've got a set, Mr. Okay. Speaker. I mean,
I had a set, but
I did this before.
There they are.
I'll donate mine because I want a brownie
now,
of mine.
Now he's got two of them.
Now I got all kinds of sets. Okay, I'll meet you with, please.
My chance for some brownie.
Mr. Chairman,
La
Copta Amendment G1, and I believe the amendments are numbered G1 through G6. The concern that was expressed a few minutes ago about being required to be on the mandatory registry, I think, is a real concern. But I wanted to get on the record that the issue of confidentiality is something that my department lives with every day of the week, and there is nothing that my department takes more seriously than the question, the issue of patient or client confidentiality. And I think my department has a very good record over the years of respecting the law in that regard. It's not infrequent that I get called to task over here with members of the legislature because we do take the issue of confidentiality so seriously. At any rate, I would recommend to the committee consideration of Amendment G1. This amendment deals with language in the bill that has gone through several iterations. But the underlying point is we don't believe that we have any reason to have information from a doctor that specifies the underlying condition that a person might have, be it hemophilia, be it HIV, be it full-blown AIDS, be it any type of cancer or any disease that or condition that would allow a physician to legitimately say the person might benefit from medical marijuana. There is no law enforcement reason for us to have that information, and I know public safety has gone on record a number of times saying if you have the card, if you're on the registry, we certainly don't care what the condition was that permitted you to get on that registry.
So you don't object to G1?
Mr. Chairman, we would recommend G1 to the committee. That is the confidentiality issue is something that we're keenly aware of. I think there will be people, as you heard previously, who will be reluctant to come forward, get on the registry, and be legal. And the only way in my mind that ultimately that gets resolved is for people over time to have confidence that the Department of Health and Social Services can be a responsible custodian of that registry, and likewise law enforcement will be responsible in their ability to access that that registry. And I think we can get there over time, Mr. Chairman.
Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Elmer, it might, you know, I might, on that issue, believe that some of those folks who don't want to be on a registry are probably currently using marijuana for medical purposes without any registration at all under illegal terms. So I don't see any big deal if they continue to be illegal, if they're not going to get picked up for it. But the problem that I have is that they might have a little problem if they didn't have the registry. Because there is no evidence. I mean, they'd have to go through a lot more issue if that were the case. And those kinds of things could happen. If a child is in the home and the child gets some marijuana out of that home, and then you wonder where the child got the marijuana, and the child got it there, if there wasn't care given so that no one that's not supposed to have it got it. Otherwise, I can't think of any reason why there's a very ill person who is using marijuana and they're not out doing it in public and they're doing it in their home, why they would be necessarily even picked up or challenged in any way, shape, or form. So, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't support mandatory registration. I think we need to do that. But if people refuse to do it, they're not in any more jeopardy, really, than they were before when they were using it illegally.
Representative Catula.
Through the chair, Mr. Lindstrom, I'm noticing your fiscal note by Dr. Nakamura, and it mentions that the department estimates that changing the registry from voluntary to mandatory will double the workload. So I guess I have to believe, as I do, that there isn't anything illegal about not registering right now, that it was voluntary, and I guess was that the department's understanding of the way that it worked right now?
Mr. Chairman, right now, today, it is a voluntary registry, and on June 1, regulations that we've developed under the current law will go into effect, and persons will be able to register voluntarily with the Department of Health and Social Services. Regarding the fiscal note, important to point out, the department had, of course, no ability to get funding in anticipation of the initiative passing. So there was a budget increment in our department's budget, which was turned down by both the House Finance Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. It was, I believe, $70,000, something of that magnitude. Without this fiscal note, which is $57,000, this legislation is not going to satisfy the real concerns of the law enforcement community, because we will not be able to provide them the information that they believe, and I believe correctly, that they have to have. Our vision is to allow them to have basically real-time access to the registry through, I am guessing, the Public Safety Information Network, their criminal justice information system. Without this money, they aren't going to have that. They aren't going to have that information.
Now, that registry was voluntary, but if the person is stopped for some reason or is caught with it without being registered, are your regs still going to require then that they can be prosecuted?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain I understand. The current regs will basically have to be rewritten from top to bottom, assuming that this legislation passes. But if the legislation didn't pass, the regs are a process for us to operate the register, but it would be voluntary for persons to apply for the register. We had planned on making that available to public safety, but of course, if a person voluntarily chose not to be on the register, when public safety would stop someone, if they hadn't chosen to register, we wouldn't know any more than the cop on the beat would know. Mm-hmm. There would be nothing in our register.
What kind of drugs do you make people register for currently?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, certainly any sort of scheme like this is unique.
Thank you.
Mr. Zangri here with me is the Chief of Vital Statistics, and it will be his office that operates the marijuana register.
Okay, in that case, Representative Murkowski.
You had sent out the notice of proposed draft regulations for your department, and you had public comment, and that closed middle of March. Have, as a result of the public comment that you received, have the regulations changed much since what was distributed in March?
Mr. Chairman, I was frankly surprised, but we got virtually no public comment on the regulations. The exception was Mr. Kinch, I believe, who was with the initiative organizers, sent us a list of suggested changes, and Mr. Finkelstein had some suggestions, many of which we could not accommodate under the existing statutory scheme. We got very little public comment, and the regulations are substantially the same as were presented to the House HES Committee several months ago.
So if I understand, then those regulations are set to take effect the 1st of June, I guess, or thereabouts. So if we were to go ahead and pass either the Senate bill or the House bill, you would essentially be back to the drawing board with your regulations. And what happens in the interim? What is in effect?
Mr. Chairman, the force of law, a new bill, the legislation would override our existing regulations to the extent our existing regulations would be contrary to anything in the amended law. I believe some of the elements probably would still remain consistent, but we would need to do additional regulations to bring in the new material from this bill to the extent the regs were invalidated by the new legislation. We would simply operate on the basis of the legislation itself until such time as we had new regulations in place. But I think this program would call for moving forward with those regulations pretty quickly.
Representative Petula?
Okay.
Are you through?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if you know this answer or not, but I see that under the bill we would allow peace officers to access the record just in the course of a criminal investigation. Do you know of any other medical records that you can just access like that without a warrant or without the person's consent? Sometimes I know the department does hold some medical records, but I've only, you know, I just wondered if you knew of any others.
Through the chair, Representative Cretullo, the department has routine access to all medical birth records.
Birth records.
Correct.
Okay, but like anyone taking drugs, I guess you wouldn't know because there wouldn't be a record of it. Thanks.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we have no objection to any of the amendments. I simply wanted to reference the one as being most
significant. Okay. Representative Green.
You have no objection. Does that mean you're ambivalent or that you would support the amendments?
We really like number one, Mr. Chairman, and we like the others okay.
Okay.
Okay. I got it. Hey, David. Waiting patiently back there.
Boy, he has.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. I'll try to cover as much as I can. It's a big subject. Feel free to interrupt me at any time before I get past something of interest.
Excuse me, David.
You'll soon come to realize that you will take advantage of that.
I don't mind, Mr. Chairman. It gives me a chance to think of what I'm going to say next. Just to put this into the bigger context, I'd like to sort of explain where we were when this legislation was initially introduced and where we are today. When this was originally introduced, it was March 4th, the day the initiative went into effect, and at that time we were quite defensive. We were extremely worried about this legislation. We felt at the time it was essentially a repeal of the initiative that the vast majority, and I think I even said at the time 95% or more of the patients who might benefit from the new law wouldn't be benefited. We thought it was a violation of the constitutional provision, and frankly we were very dispirited because the legislature certainly has the right to take these things up. We felt it was going to be very hard to do very well. While we did well with the public, my experience just from having talked to legislators, counting votes, while the issue was popular with the public, it wasn't so popular with the legislature. Certainly it wouldn't have passed if you counted up the votes within the legislature, maybe not by a 2-to-1 margin. So it was really, the folks who supported the initiative and our organization felt very discouraged. Things have changed since then, and I just want to make that note. The administration and Senator Lehman have, I think, been trying their best to respond to many of the concerns expressed by doctors and by patients. We greatly appreciate the efforts they've made on that effort. We remain opposed to this legislation, and I'd be glad to go over all those issues, but we continue to try to work with the administration and with the sponsor, and I don't want anything I say to take away from their efforts to try to find something that will not alienate and eliminate from the benefits of this law the patients of the state. Just to give a quick outline on how we got here, because there's sort of a sense that some of these provisions sound sort of broad or sounds too high a limit. The California initiative, which is the only one that passed in the country prior to this, is a very short initiative, has one page. We put in, I don't remember how many pages the final one was, but 10 or so pages of details. We tried to get to the number one complaint in California, which was there was no details. So we tried to provide the details. And there's certainly legitimate complaints that the sponsor of the department has with some of those and with the way they're laid out. But we wanted to get to that issue, and that's the reason there was so little response to the regulations, is that many of those issues were already dealt with in the statute through the initiative, the kind of things in California that they didn't have dealt with. The other thing we tried to learn from the California experience was amounts. California has no limit on amounts, and of all the initiatives that have passed around the country, the standard of 1 ounce, 1 ounce, six plants, and only above that if you can prove in court that's medically justified, that's the lowest limit of any state that's adopted an initiative. I think, well, California, as I said, has no limits. It's what, you know, you can prove, what you can show. In Oregon, I think it's 2 months' supply. I can't remember the other states, but I know there's none that's any lower than us. And there are, that whole issue of amounts, you know, it's 1 ounce and six plants, it just isn't a very large amount. Even the 4 ounce figure, which is, or the four ounces, which they said was the average, this is not the average of patients sitting at home trying to grow some plants. This is the average of people who have been arrested for growing marijuana commercially. I mean, it's pros versus amateurs, but I don't think the experience of most patients is that they're going to achieve the same thing that commercial growers operating criminal sales operations could do. The other factor, too, which patients have explained to me, is that you're allowed six plants, three of them mature, so you could start off some others. It's really only three mature plants. That's the limit, not six. Three plants that produce usable marijuana. Now you're starting out the other plants. When the other plants start out, some are males, some are females. The patients eliminate the males. The males don't produce the usable amount. And I don't know if the ratio is 50-50 or what, but there's a certain portion you lose from that culling operation. So it's much more complicated than it sounds. I don't think a simpler formula of 4 ounces times six plants is the case. It'd be 4 ounces times three plants, but it is 4 ounces, and you often never even achieve the three plants. It's the lowest limit as we could come up with and still give them a chance of producing some usable marijuana. If you said one or two plants, and they plant two seeds, and they come out males, they flock. And again, there is no lower limit in the country of the states that have these initiatives. California initiative of 96 didn't have any set list of medical conditions. It was basically for whatever Dr. Walk wanted to recommend. I personally believe that's the way it should be done. I think the patient-physician relationship should be allowed to operate. If a licensed doctor in the state of Alaska wants to recommend it for a patient, I think that's fine. We didn't choose that approach. We named a list of conditions. That's because a complaint in California was people are going to get it for a hangnail or something. So we had to, there has to be something that's actually off the list. The registration system has come in for a lot of complaints, as if it was something deceptive to have a registration system. There hasn't been a single state in the country that's adopted these initiatives that has mandatory registration. What the states are striving for, like in California and some of the local jurisdictions, is for optional registration. They want to set up a system so patients who want to can sign up, and those folks will have a card that'll be a get-out-of-jail-free card with the local law enforcement officials so that they have a way to protect themselves. But in California and all the other states, no one has to register. Some states chose optional systems, some have none, but there isn't a state in the country that has a mandatory registration system. The system was for the benefit of the patients. Many patients, though, the kind of patients who aren't going to register are ones who, you know,